Physician, heal thyself.
I know her. Yeah, we've been talking. Are you from San Diego as well?
We're from
Texas. Well, you're from here, like
is it all in Florida?
Oh, very good. Glad you're getting really good. Hosting us. It's been very nice.
My computer, turn on.
Oh, it's already displaying a computer.
Yeah, I know that. But I think so. I'm just trying to get this computer to respond.
All right. Well, give me a holler if you need me.
There we go. Answering the hard questions. By the way, the title's just Hard Questions, just so you know.
You just present hard questions.
Yeah, hard questions. But the title of the PowerPoint is Hard Questions.
Is that the hardest thing for you to find
out? True.
Okay. I think our thing is we close the door, yes? So that we don't interrupt. Thank you, it's on.
Yeah.
All right. We'll leave one door open a little bit temporarily while the last couple people come in. Okay, good. Let me see here. So, answering the hard questions. That's clearly something that the Christian apologists in the church should be involved in doing, I would say. Now, my experience says that for all practical purposes, all the hard questions are theological ones. There's a lot of skeptics throw a lot of stuff out, and for example, the situation I shared in my class this morning about the lady who said the Bible's full of all these science errors. I say, well, that's easy to say, but to me, that's easy to refute, because the fact is, there are none. And unless somebody can raise one, I haven't heard of any. So, the statement that the Bible's full of all kinds of historical errors and fables and all that kind of stuff. My response to that is, well, can you give me one? Do you have any examples of this? Or the idea you can't trust the reliability of the Bible because, Constantine changed the Bible. These kinds of questions, I mean, I'm not saying we laugh at them or brush them up. Far from it. What I'm saying is, so many of the questions that I get at my website are, in my opinion, relatively easily handled, relatively easily answered. We have facts, we have information we can give. But like I said, to me, the hard questions, almost without exception, are theological ones. So I'm going to throw out a list of some that I think are worth discussing, and these are the ones I plan on getting into. I'm going to do the least time on letter D, because we had a whole class on that. So the question of the Trinity. Now, of the ones that are up there, that's the one probably thinking, why is that a big deal? All right. But the other five, I think we could all agree that these questions, these raise legitimate questions that sincere Christians who believe in God struggle with. In fact, that's part of the reason our last session is going to include a class on dealing with doubt. All right. So the question is, how can a God who knows everything, all right, how can he allow free will? How can he know it's going to happen without making it happen? That seems to be a logical contradiction. How can a God who's all-powerful and all-loving and has created everything good, that's the Christian worldview, then how do you explain the nature of evil? In a world where God is all-powerful and all-knowing and omniscient and all these omni things, how could babies be born with horrible birth defects and then die? How's that fit your worldview? And why is God have these Jews going around committing genocide? How's that fit Jesus saying love your enemy? These are fairly good questions. And if God is so amazing, so awesome, and so wonderful, what the heck's this stuff about hell? I almost said what the never. Yeah. All right, what's all this stuff about hell? And these are all theological questions. Now, some of these are worldview questions. some are more Christian questions. So we're going to do a little bit more discussion with this class than my other two. So which of these are clearly worldview questions? In other words, all worldviews need to be called to account, and we're going to do a comparative study of worldview of some of these, and others, it's really a Christian question. Yeah. Which is a worldview question?
D and F kind of are.
Alright, pain and suffering, all worldviews need to deal with that question. Violence and slavery, no, I don't agree with that. That's a Christian question. The reason
is... which ones are there?
Our worldview questions, right? Because the violence and slavery in the Old Testament, your Hindu doesn't have to worry about that.
I misunderstood.
You see what I'm saying? So that's a Christian question. All right, got it? So we're not going to do a worldview study on that one. All right, C, the question of evil, right? All people have to deal with that question. Any others that are clearly worldview? F? Yeah, I don't know about hell. But certainly, is justice a real word? What's the meaning of that? All right, so in those cases, we're going to do a little worldview analysis. And the others, we're not going to because it doesn't really make sense. But one thing I think they all have in common is that they're all hard questions, and they're all theological. So there you go. The hard questions, I believe, are theological.
Isn't free will kind of a worldview thing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Did I not? Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah, and predestination, clearly. How do we skip that? Well, I don't know. I asked you, and nobody said anything. It's we.
I figured free will was, but the foreknowledge and predestination, more of a Christian slant on that. So.
Yeah. Now, I'm not going to review what a worldview is and that kind of stuff. We don't need that anymore. That's kind of boring. And probably... most of you have been at least in one class I've taught this weekend or week or whatever. But I do want to say that of the three questions that are here, we're principally going to be looking at the middle one, right? So again, not all these questions are even worldview, so I'm just going to barely park on the slide at all. But when we do some worldview studies here, we're going to think in terms of how does this relate to, for example, all right, fine, is... the question of evil a problem for Christianity? Yeah, on some level, clearly it is. But what about for Hinduism? What about for, existentialism? And by the way, suffering is a big issue in existentialism. That's one of the main questions that are raised by existentialism. So here's the Christian worldview. And this is going to be really important to answering the hard questions. So I'm going to spend more time on this than the other two classes. The Christian worldview... there's no particular order here, although this is Genesis 1:1, the first point here. Now, according to the Christian worldview, the physical world is real. It's not imaginary. Therefore, the things we're going to discuss are not something you can simply ignore as being not real. And it's created from nothing, and it is good. So the Christian worldview, Genesis 1, is it 28? How good was it, by the way, according to God? Everything? Very good. Do some of these questions at least... Do some of these, seem at least at first glance to come up against that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So these are legitimate questions. And I hope by now you've been bothered by the question of pain and suffering at some point in your Christian life. I hope so. I hope that hell bothers you. If hell doesn't bother you, wow. Yeah, hell, obviously. really? That's a hard question. And so this first point in my particular version of having kind of tried to write down what I would think of the Christian worldview as being, clearly this is going to be an essential thing to address. There is a physical and a spiritual reality. They're both real, and humans occupy both realms. In that sense, we are both physical and spiritual. The creator of both is the God that we know of in the Bible. Being both physical and spiritual, however, our spiritual nature is the more essential nature. Our spirituality is the more essential truth about us than our physicality, although they're both true. Because our physical nature is eternal, our physical bodies are not. And then God is characterized by a number of qualities. This I glossed over yesterday, but I want to talk about that. That God has some qualities. And I'm going to claim here that every quality God has it to an infinite extent. And when we talk about the question of hell, these qualities are going to come up, and they're going to bubble up, and we're going to have to deal with that. His qualities include being love. Not just he is loving, but that he is love. And he is just. Now, in the current version of Christianity in America, which one do we talk about all the time?
Love.
And which one do we almost never even mention? Even it's in our holiness. Churches, never mind in evangelical Christianity.
It's holiness, it's
so some of these questions are because we don't put before our people all the qualities of God, I think, in the emphasis that we should. And when we emphasize qualities of God too much by comparison to the others, we create problems. For example, Augustine and Luther and others, Calvin, they emphasize one of God's qualities, which is his sovereignty,
right.
Which God is everything he is absolutely and infinitely, including infinitely just and infinitely sovereign. And yet, if you emphasize that to the exclusion, to some extent, of love or these other qualities, then you get an unbalanced theology. And it also makes you unable to answer some of these questions satisfactorily. So those are the qualities that we're aware of. We could probably add one or two to the list. We have about an 8 or 9 hour class on Christian theology that you can get at our website. God's creation, including the physical world, is good. Evil exists. Now, I'm not going to finish reading that because then I'm giving away part of the answer to one of the questions. Because of God's justice and holiness, those who rebel against him will be judged. And that, I think, is an essential component, that whole creation, fall, redemption. And to take judgment out of the Christian worldview, I mean, oh my goodness. Okay, and then, of course, there's the solution. That we're going to end our class with that solution, which is pretty great. All right, so these are some of the competing worldviews we've been looking at this weekend. Let's talk about the Trinity. Okay? Now, I want somebody here to explain the Trinity to me. I got it. See, so this is an apologetic issue, isn't it? All right, now, most of the time, I would say in 99-point-something% of our Christian life, it's just not an issue, and it's not even an important question. But to say that it's not a hard question is certainly wrong, and to say that we shouldn't think about it and be prepared to answer questions. Now, who's going to raise the question about the Trinity the most? Anybody know if you've been around?
Muslims.
Good luck with that one, folks. Defending the Trinity to a Muslim. That is not easy. They're going to accuse you of tritheism. And you say, well, look what it says in John 1:1. Do you think that's going to solve the problem? Okay. Now, I talked in my class earlier today about Thomas Aquinas, who said, belief is rational. And I don't buy that fully. Because I don't see anything rational about, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. Let's parse that one out. Let's analyze that and see how logical that is. Okay, so the Trinity is an apologetic question that, to be honest with you, it's not something that we have to deal with all that often, but if you're living in Jordan, if you're living in India, if you're living in Indonesia, are you kidding? All right, if you run a Christian evidence website. Yeah. Okay, so what is the Christian apologetic with reference to the Trinity? So let's just let some people kind of throw some stuff out there. How would you explain this? Yeah.
I do have John's Gospel, and I go to him.
Right.
Beheld his glory, the glory of the one and only God. No one has seen God at any time. God, the only Son, right. Has made him known. Jesus is the vision.
Right.
God.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate. I'm some secular guy out there in the street and say, that's what it says in the Bible, but that's not logical.
Yes, and what I would respond is, itself. The Christian belief is you cannot know who God really is.
Okay. Okay.
And I challenge any other religion to say who God really is.
All right. Now, my first thought when you're saying that, I'm just be honest, because I was pretending I was a secular guy, is that sounds really fishy. In other words, we're saying, I can't answer the question, I'm not going to answer the question, don't ask the question. But by the way, I believe that is part of the Christian answer to that question. But it's partly because it's a hard question. All right? Because really, it's about the mystery. And I think part of the answer to that question is Christianity has always presented it as a mystery, has not tried to claim that it's logical. In fact, if you know church history, when Christians have tried to explain it logically, they always end up in some kind of a heresy. So I was pretending I was a non-Christian. Forgive me for having this impure thought towards you, in a sense. Like, whatever, just religious mumbo-jumbo. You know, and besides, I just noticed he didn't even answer my question. You know what I'm saying? Forgive me for saying that, but the honest truth is, I think that is a legitimate answer to the question. Probably I'd suggest you might have to kind of back that up a little bit more, and it's hard to do, though. In a 90-second conversation, that's tough.
Well, Paul says, the unknown God, I can tell you who he is.
Yeah, exactly.
And they dug up this idol altar in Rome, mm-hmm. to a god or goddess, whoever it may be.
Yeah.
There's a visual of the problem that no one has ever seen God at any time. I mean, no god.
Good. Any other thoughts? How are you gonna explain to a Muslim that we believe Father, Son, Holy Spirit, all God, and yet we're not tritheists? Okay. I'm going to claim that for me as this skeptic, you haven't answered my question. I'm going to claim that. You have not logically helped me out here and explain how it can be. You see what I'm saying? You see what I'm saying? Because you're dealing with somebody who has no concept of the Christian worldview. All right, and I'm saying, help me out here. Is it three gods or is it one God? Help me out here. You see what I'm saying? Yeah, go ahead.
I use the analogy of, assuming you're a Star Trek fan or something like that.
Okay.
That God is, or it's, you know, something, that God is another type of being, like an alien, if you want to. This is just an analogy.
It's a being we don't understand, in other words?
God is another type of a being. There's a human being and there's a tribble or whatever you want to, God is another type of being and that has certain qualities, and there are only three of them. You know, like there's three beings of this nature, and as you go into their nature, there are things we can't comprehend about mm-hmm. that nature, but that's a good way of thinking about it. So we worship that kind of a being.
Yeah. Now, again, I'm playing the part.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm like, oh, whatever. You know what I'm saying? So there. What's being illustrated here, folks, is this is a hard question.
It is.
In fact, this will be a hard question till the day you die if you're dealing with somebody who doesn't understand the Christian worldview. And to me, in the end, I don't know if you were there in my first class, I taught different kinds of apologetics. And to me, in the end, in order to understand this, you simply need to know the God of Christianity. And even at that point, I'm not sure we could fully logically justify this unusual idea. Michael, do you have a thought to add?
It is a hard question. I was just going to say to me that I try to explain it with an analogy.
Right, analogy is one way. The ice, the liquid water, and the gaseous water, the sun, the light, the heat.
Yeah, to me the best one, and they're all analogies are lacking, is time.
Uh-huh.
In the sense of, because you have past, present, and future.
Okay.
They're all time. The past is time, the present is time, the future is time, but they're distinguishable from one another. You need all three. So the past is not the present is not the future.
Mm-hmm.
But the past is always time, the present is always time. And so it starts to give a picture of who God is.
Right. Okay, go ahead.
I'll ask first if you're a chemist, then I'll do a chemist.
Yeah.
Saying three compounds of nitrogen, or three molecules of nitrogen are together. They're three separate ones, but the three are...
By the way, just, you know, every single one of these analogies, which can be helpful, if you parse them out carefully, they're all heresies. I mean, the honest truth. All right? Yeah.
Ultimately, and this is where I try to get to the heart of the matter, why are you asking the question? Let's go from there. But ultimately, understanding this, I think, is beyond our realm.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best illustrations of that, I go back to John Clayton when I saw him way back when, and I think he's going to do the same speech tonight, is if we were two-dimensional people and trying to understand something in the third dimension, right?
Right, and the flatland thing.
The flatland, yeah. And that, I mean, I heard it when I was in college. That just blew my mind.
Yeah.
But that's exactly
right. By the way, I'm going to kind of give my answer to my own question, but John Clayton's way of dealing with that with using flatland, I think, is one of the better ones. I want to tell you that my suggestion is to some extent, and I was going to say, don't write it down. It's going to be on the recording. Is to some extent, I think we might want to try to duck that question, at least at first.
Oh, cop out, yeah.
You know, to some extent. And because it is a mystery. It is a mystery. Okay, I'll take one more comment. Go ahead.
Well, kind of along with what this brother said, if you use apologetics, you can say that there was a historical Jesus.
Right.
He lived and he died. Resurrection is
that's exactly what I was going to say. I believe the best thing you do with that question is point them to Jesus, which is what you were doing, exactly. But however, we might want to not couch it in such religious, you know, stuff that people might not kind of get, you know. But, and especially with the Muslims, I think what we need to do is at least temporarily, if we can, not blow off the question or refuse to answer it, admit that it is a mystery, you know, and looking at John 1, admit that at least on some level, at least appears to not even be logical, but then bring them to Jesus and show that he is who he said he was. And of course, the Quran even calls the New Testament, the Injil part of, you know, the book, it calls Christians people of the book, and the miracles of Jesus, the prophecy fulfillment of Jesus, and just the life of Jesus and the resurrection of Jesus. And the fact that he got before people and said, before Abram was born, I am. And Jesus claimed to be God, and by his life he showed it. And exactly what that means about the Trinity, you know, I'm not sure that. But the way my friend Paul Chacon put it is, he said, it's not logical, it's godgical.
Gotcha.
It's godgical. Yeah, there are things about the gospel that may not be able to be analyzed fully by human logic. This is a tough one. It's a tough question. And I think we need to handle it carefully. Another question people try to corner you, do you believe in the Trinity doctrine? I don't like that question, to be honest with you, because there's all kind of baggage of Roman Catholicism that comes in there, and the word Trinity, Tertullian made that up. And, all right, but let me kind of get down to how I would deal with it. There's a mystery, and there's aspects of Christianity that are not rational. And if you try to get in a rational discussion with somebody who's into predestination, you might lose that argument, actually. And Timothy said it is a mystery. It's a mystery kept hidden. And like it says in 1 Corinthians, that Jesus is a stumbling block to the Greek because, you know, to them, it's not logical that God, who is impassive and unchanging and perfect and all these things, that God could occupy a human body. But I'd say that's the most beautiful thing about Christianity, that God became flesh. The incarnation is really, in some sense anyway, what separates Christianity from all other religions. That's what I'm talking about. God became flesh. It's about God's love. The Trinity is about God's love. And the mystery is that God the creator of the universe, came in human form and dwelled for a while among us. The exact verses you are quoting, I mean, that's where I'm going to go. But to be honest with you, not to explain it, not necessarily to explain it, but to hope that it would be revealed to them as they read the scriptures, as they meet Jesus. So generally, if you're trying to share with a Muslim, I would not go for a one-hour debate on the Trinity as the first step to introducing them to Christianity. I think it's possible. It may not even go awesome, superly well for you. And so bear that in mind. Okay? So to me, the apologetics ultimately of the Trinity is that God became a man so he could reach out to us, so they could know us, and so that we could know him. And, you know, I've had Muslims say it's a scandal that God went to the bathroom. You know? It's a scandal that his mother wiped his butt. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you can see why you can see why they say that. I'd say that is the most beautiful thing about Christianity.
Yeah.
That God became flesh. The God of the Bible is a God who came near, who knew us, who empathizes with us. He suffered in every way just like he did. But again, that's an emotional argument.
Yeah.
That's not a rational argument. In the end, it's a mystery. And so admitting that it's a mystery may be part of what we need to do. But even having said that, I think we're all kind of sitting there. It's a hard question. And even though we could talk about it for hours, I'm planning on kind of going on to the next one.
Okay.
Yeah.
The language of mystery in the New Testament, if you say Paul was talking about the mystery religions, it's saying.
Oh, certainly not mystery religions, that's for sure.
Well, you divulge the mystery, they kill you. Paul says, here's the mystery for you.
Right?
It's revealed, plain, and public for all to know. That's what God thinks about the mystery.
Right.
In your face, mystery religion.
Right. Here he is. He's walking on earth. And Jesus says, it's at hand, right? The mystery, he didn't literally say the mystery is at hand, but Jesus is at hand. That's good. All right. So here's another one. How can God foreknow without predetermining? That's a hard question. I think we might have to be back on the flatland thing again. If God already knows what's going to happen, then why is there evil in the world? So the question about predestination, the question about free will, these are, and the question about evil, and the question about pain and suffering, I believe they're all connected on some level. But what I want to do is, I want to kind of fast forward through that, and we're going to come back to this question about how can God foreknow without predetermining from a human perspective that seems illogical. And we could talk about God existing outside of time, which I believe he does. But I want to get straight to the question about the problem of evil. Now, of course, there's Augustine, who had this concept of predestination, where God basically has chosen. We have no power to respond to God. That if God didn't choose us, we would never have been saved. And there's the elect. And all the other people, they're elect also, but they're elect to go to hell. I'm glad I don't have to answer that question, because when people ask me about that, I say, that's not a biblical teaching, all right? But what about evil? Let's talk about evil. Okay? So I'm going to throw some questions out here. Let me see. Blah, blah, blah. I may want to go ahead and skip some of these questions here. There's too much stuff here. All right, let's talk about evil for a bit. In fact, there's all this stuff about predestination. Oh, man. All right, yeah, let's talk about evil for a minute.
That's an evil looking devil.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about evil. Is evil real according to the Christian worldview?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well then, what is it?
Would you step to the side? I can't see
So what is it? We did this in our Bible group last Tuesday. All right, so what is evil? And, you know, I think a lot of people in our churches have not really thought about this. They can identify a thing as evil, like murder, that's evil, or it's the result of evil. Is evil a thing? Yeah.
it's intangible, first of all, I would tell you. It's not like you could point at something and say there's a pile of
evil. There's a pile of evil.
Yeah, that doesn't exist.
You're arguing that it's not a thing per se.
It's not a thing. It's intangible. It's a characteristic of something or someone, primarily the someone in the case of the human beings. But the best way I can describe it is the absence of God.
Okay. So, okay, you're getting to the next question. All right, so evil is real. According to the, and by the way, we're going to talk about other worldviews and evil, but according to the Christian worldview, evil is real, but it seems to not be a thing. And the reason I know it's not a thing is because everything that exists is good and created by God. Now, by the way, this may not be correct, but it's the Christian explanation as far as I understand it, because everything is good. Everything is good. Everything God created is good. Evil is real, and so evil mustn't be a thing. Now, the next thing that people tend to say is it's like light and darkness. Is darkness a thing?
No, it's just the absence of light.
It's just the absence of light. Is cold a thing? No. We lived in Wisconsin. It seemed like a thing there, but no. A cold is the absence of warmth. Warmth is a thing. Heat is a thing. A cold is not. Light is a thing. Darkness is not. So maybe that's what evil is. Maybe evil is the lack of good. But that's not what it is. If you have no evil, no good, evil is not the lack of good. All right? It's not like if you take all the, if you remove all the good, that's not what evil is. Go ahead. Somebody, I thought.
C.S. Lewis, in Paradise Lost, says, Milton says, evil is a parasite. It's a bending and a twisting and a distortion.
Okay, good. Good. Yeah, that's a paraphrase of Augustine. And I guarantee you that C.S. Lewis was looking at Augustine when he said that. And by the way, this is just Augustine. This is not the Bible. And I don't know of a single passage in the Bible that says what evil is, as in, evil is this. It says this is evil, that is evil. There's things that are clearly described as being evil. But I'm not sure, and maybe somebody could find a verse. I'm not sure of a verse that really just flat out says, look, this is what evil is.
There's a definition in Jeremiah, I can't remember the verse, but it talks about evil is you don't do what God says.
Right, I'm not right. We can say, okay, so evil is not doing what God said. So if you do absolutely nothing, then you're not doing it.
Then you got to deal with him who knows the good and doesn't do it itself.
Yeah, I think it's saying one of the things in this world that is evil is not doing God's will. Another thing in this world that is evil is abortion. Another thing in this world that is evil is lying. Another thing in this world that is evil is murder. Another thing that all knowing the good and not doing it is evil, right? Let me throw out Augustine's definition. It's not even in the Bible, and I'm not trying to get you to accept his definition, all right? That's not what I'm trying to do, okay? I'm not here to defend Augustine's definition of evil, but I have to admit, I like it. It does seem to answer all the questions that I've ever had about evil, and so I'm just going to read it, okay? And please, don't go away with the impression I was trying to tell you this is the definition of evil, and I made a statement I might even have to backtrack on, and please, if I do, just help me out and I'll do it, that I don't know of any one verse that specifically defines evil in its full sense. But here's what he said. Evil arises from the corruption of a nature which is essentially good. In other words, something that was good became evil, and how did that happen? Well, he's going to explain that or attempt to. What is called evil is good, which has been corrupted. If it were not corrupted, it would be wholly good. But even when it is corrupted, it is good insofar as it remains a natural thing, and bad in only so far as it was corrupted. So, for example, sex is not evil, but adultery sure is, and so is lust. Eating food is not evil, but gluttony sure is. All right, and love is not evil, and even jealousy is not evil per se. All right, if your spouse is cheating on you, I hope you're jealous. You better be, you know. If God is jealous also. But there are forms of jealousy which are clearly evil, but that's the corruption of something that was good. Now, again, in fact, I'll just throw it up for under discussion. I'm afraid all kinds of stuff is going to come up and we're going to go up. But, you know, let's go ahead and do it anyway. Unfortunately, Augustine kind of went in a bad direction with this. Because basically he said that when Adam sinned, you know, the whole saying of the Calvinists, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. And we inherit, it's sort of a genetically, we inherit evil through birth. And that's why the Catholics have the doctrine of Immaculate Conception, because obviously evil is passed on through the father, not through the mother. And that's why, you know, there was Jesus was born of a virgin because, you know, evil is, you know, all this sort of stuff. Augustine believed in free will, and he said our freedom of will was we got to choose which evil we do, but not whether we do evil or not. And basically his free will was a truncated free will, which was virtually not a free will at all. The bottom line is we don't have free will. All right, and so we are, of course, we can read Romans 3 and say that in some sense, clearly, you know, we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But anyway, any discussion, any maybe a reflection on Augustine's attempt to at least help us think about what evil is. He says it's the corruption of something that would have been good if the free will agent had not chosen to use that thing for evil. Yeah. Okay, go ahead. Right.
And what you just said, we're not born with sin. It's a choice.
We're not born responsible for what somebody else did.
Yes. And when babies are not born in sin, we make a choice to sin when we do wrong. But this whole concept of sinful nature.
Yeah, that is a tough concept. Because, you know, I think we can agree that we do have free will and that we're otherwise, if we didn't have a choice, then how could God hold us responsible for something that he forced us to do, essentially? So what happened at the fall? That's one of the hardest questions, I think, really to deal with.
Well, see, if I can say easily that a baby isn't born of sin, but if God says we have sinful nature, mm-hmm. wouldn't that be in us when we're born? But it doesn't, it can't come out until
I think we're going to probably go back to Ezekiel 18 that says the Father is not responsible for the sin of the Son of the Father, and we're certainly not responsible for Adam's sin. But apparently it's clear biblically that we inherited a tendency towards sin that so far I haven't met somebody who managed to get around that. But apparently God feels like we're responsible. God does not hold people responsible for something they were not given the choice about, because that's not justice. That's a tough question. Okay? So why is there evil in the world? The way I think about it is this, that God gave us a choice. That's why that tree was in the garden. Because love gives a choice. In fact, you can't force somebody to love you. And if you try to force somebody to love you, that's not love. That's not loving. That's selfishness. That's pride and all that sort of stuff. So a loving creator in his love and power created a people to love and to love him, but with a choice, a real choice, not a fake choice. And unfortunately, Adam and Eve, even though they had one choice, was a beautiful, perfect relationship with their father, walking the garden unashamed. They chose to rebel against God. They chose to reject what he had for them. They chose to do evil. And the fact that we inherit a tendency in that direction is, that's a troubling thing, I would say. But it, clearly it's what the Bible presents. And if anybody wants to say we don't have a tendency towards evil, then if there's a worldview that says we don't have that, I would say that's clearly in conflict with what we know from experience. Yeah, go ahead.
So, thinking about the fall, and before the fall and after the world's ended and we go to heaven, which is, I think, a restoration of what it was like.
Right.
So, we all experience evil desires, the sinful nature, whatever you want to call it, that you're describing. Do you think that Adam and Eve did not have Romans 7, you know, the evil desires before they sinned? Do you think they had only good, strong, godly desires, and that that's what we'll have again in heaven? And that was that only happened because of the fall. We then had a sinful nature and sinful desires, and they've been a part of our fleshly nature since then. Is that?
I think that's pretty close to what I understand from, okay, from the Bible, yeah. All right, yeah, go ahead.
One of the passages I go to specifically is in Romans 1, where it talks about the fact that the reason we need God, I mean, here's the law, and if you can follow the law perfectly, which nobody can because we're not perfect, that's, you know, where we go down, then we wouldn't need God. We wouldn't need, right, Jesus in salvation. Mm-hmm. But nobody can follow their conscience perfectly,
yeah,
because of that fact, we need God. We,
right,
need a Savior.
Yeah.
So.
And to some extent, this brings up, well, what about heaven? But that's one of the questions that I'll deal with later on. Yeah, go ahead.
I think two things from what you're saying. One is that the things you mentioned that weren't inherently bad, I don't think that they're necessarily inherently good either. So, like, sex can be used for bad.
Yeah, right.
Or it could be used to create, mm-hmm, marriage. So it's,
yeah,
it's a tool that's used to create good or bad.
Right. Science is neither good nor bad. It just is. And yet it can be used for good or for evil, as was discussed in Kirk's talk earlier. That's correct.
And then
okay.
And then I also think you got a quote on there about free will leads us to enforcing our selfish desires and stuff. I think something that... it was one of Augustine's quotes.
All right. And yeah, Augustine had a fairly negative view of free will that we had. Yes,
I
clearly.
Something that's missing from our discussion is the ability of our free will to submit to God in obedience and do what he wants.
Right, yeah.
Taking his will on.
Right, Augustine taught that we didn't have that ability to do that, that we need to know God before we can obey him, essentially.
Because he was so frustrated with the sin nature.
Yeah. So this is Augustine again. He said, sin is not the striving after an evil nature, but the desertion of a better, and so the deed itself is not evil, the nature, but not the, is evil rather, not the nature which the sinner uses amiss, for it is evil to use amiss that which is good. All right, and so, you know, some of the things, like, for example, sex is in fact actually good. It is an actual positive good. It's not necessarily neutral. You know, so, some of our emotions are in fact actually good. They're not neutral, but they can be corrupted and used in bad ways. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I can't even let myself listen to it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's his view of concupiscence, because, yeah, he views, I mean, he translated lust, but it means evil desires in all kinds of areas.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he says it's so strong, and he has some history with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so strong in me, I have to fight it by simply the monastic approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and so,
exactly.
I'm
thankful that we've not accepted that,
yeah,
because I believe it's false teaching. I prefer Thomas Aquinas on this question much better. And again, this is not scripture, but I kind of like this statement. I think it does answer a question about free will. Because if God is sovereign, and he's totally sovereign, then obviously by definition his will always be done, right? No. Because why did Jesus pray for God's will to be done if it's always done? He's wasting his time and his energy there. So this is Thomas Aquinas on the question of free will, which I believe also touches on the question of evil and also on the question of pain and suffering. He said, God, therefore, is the first cause, Now I'm going to have to unpack some of this big fancy language here, okay? God, therefore, is the first cause who moves causes both natural and voluntary. All right? And just as by moving natural causes, he does not prevent their actions from being natural, so by moving voluntary causes, he does not provide their actions of being voluntary. But rather, he is the cause of this very thing in them, for he operates in them in each thing according to his own nature. In other words, he's saying most everything God created acts naturally. Therefore, they cannot sin. Rocks cannot sin. Clouds cannot sin. Dogs can pee on your carpet, but they cannot sin. Grass cannot sin. Only God's creations who are given a choice, who are given their own local sovereignty, if you will, only they can choose. And if God gives us a sovereignty, and why did God give us a sort of local sovereignty? What's the Christian view on that? Why God gave us free will? Because he wanted us to love him and he wants to love us. And so if God, in his sovereign choice, gives us sovereignty, that does not take away his sovereignty. If I am the leader and I say, I delegate this to you, when you do that, and I've said, you know, I gave you that delegation, then I'm responsible for what you did and you get to do that thing. So basically said, the fact that God has given us free will, which, by the way, isn't that part of our, we're in the image of God, and that includes a few things. One, that we're spiritual, we have soul, we have these emotions that God has, we have self-conscious or self-aware. But I believe one of the aspects of us being in the image of God is that we are sovereign. And he's given that to us. And the fact that God gives us sovereignty, and sovereignty implies responsibility. We're responsible before God for what we do with that thing he gave us. So Aquinas argued that free will is not in conflict with God's sovereignty, whereas Augustine said it is. And I'm sorry, but I agree with Thomas Aquinas. Yeah, go ahead.
So from what Aquinas says, and I've toyed with, Romans 8:28, God causes all things to work out for good. So even if we in our sovereignty disobey God, he overrides our sovereignty by causing things to work out towards his will anyway. So from our perspective, do we have the illusion of free will?
No, if it's an illusion, then it's not real.
No, but from our perspective, it is. Because everything I know... Let me give an example.
Okay, for example, is predestination in the Bible?
Yes.
Of course it is.
Yeah, it is.
What did God predestine? That all of us would have the opportunity to go to heaven.
Yeah, and
when our sovereignty got in the way of God's sovereignty, which is to create that, he wasn't afraid to kind of tweak us around just a little bit. All right, so, you know, Pharaoh, he hardened his heart to bring about God's will. And even in the case of Judas, God kind of, you know, Jesus even said, hey, just get busy there, you know, essentially. But did God take away Pharaoh's ability to choose whether he would go to heaven or hell? I don't think so.
And from Pharaoh's...
Pharaoh could have repented? What prevented Pharaoh from repenting? Who was worse, Peter or Judas? I mean, who denied it worse? I don't know. So I don't think... See, that's how amazing God is. This is how I respond to it. God is so amazing, so much smarter than us.
Yeah.
He can give us our sovereignty and never take it away.
Ever. We never know.
Right, that's
like
true.
Pharaoh never knew that God hardened his heart.
No.
If he didn't read in the Bible, we wouldn't know.
Now, the Pharisees, you know, the ones who offered 30 pieces of silver to Judas, they knew it. I like to think, you know, I like to think what happened, you know, a few weeks later. They're reading Zechariah 11. It says 30 pieces. The price, like, it was the price.
Dang.
They're like, oh, man. But anyway, now, I'm going to ask you, I'm making a statement based on faith. Based on faith, which is, I believe God never overcomes our free will. Because love just doesn't do that. Does he try to work around that in a sense? Does he try to take the things? For example, let's say somebody, a husband abuses his wife. Was that God's will? No. Well, was it God's will to have a universe where that could happen? Yes. could God use those circumstances to create an ultimate good in a different direction if we would come under his will? Yes. All right, but the existence of free will in the end does not contradict God's sovereignty. That's the way I understand it. Now, let's talk about other worldviews and how they deal with evil. There's dualism, which is the Manichaeism of Augustine, or Zoroastrianism. And dualism says there's evil, it's a thing, and there's good, it's a thing. Okay? And they're equal, and neither will ever overcome the other, because they're both things. I don't know if that's an improvement on the biblical answer to the question of evil. And then there's pantheism that says evil's not real. Now, does denying something is real, does that make it less real? All right, so again, I have to admit that the Christian answer to the question of evil, it's not simple. Well, in a sense it is. In a sense it's not. But the other worldviews, they really stink at dealing with the question of evil. Because the Eastern religion says it's not even real. Well, that really helps deal with the evil problem. All right, and naturalism says there's no such thing as evil. And, you know, scientific determinism says it's not real. Postmodernism says evil? What's that? It's evil for you, but not for me. Is the evil's all relative? And then there's the Calvinist response to evil, or the Muslim response to evil, which is predestination, fate. Excuse me. So God is the author both of good and of evil. I don't know. I go with the Christian answer. I think it's the best answer out there. Yeah.
Quick question. The pantheism. Not very familiar with it. Is there a particular religion in which that's from?
Hinduism. Absolutely. Okay. Jain. Sikhism. Buddhism is not formally pantheistic, but in essence, Buddhism is pantheistic. Basically, Buddhism tried to skirt the question. But everything he says reveals that he was pantheist. He believed in reincarnation and the Hindu cosmology and all that. So basically, the idea of this is kind of called monism. That's a big fancy word. Basically, God is everything and everything is God. And therefore, evil's not real. And neither is this thing real. Good luck living up to that worldview. But as far as the question of evil, boy, does it really miss the boat on that one. To say that evil is not real. Okay? So again, I believe the Christian worldview is the only satisfactory answer to the question of evil. That's why I'm going to go on to the next question. Evil is real. Indirectly, it is the product of God's love. In essence, you know, you could hold God accountable for that if you want on Judgment Day. Good luck with that one. But I say, what's the alternative?
How would you
that we don't exist at all?
Yeah.
Or we're automatons? We're like a fern? Or, you know, do you have a better universe you want to sort of make up? You know, so God loved us so much that he gave us a choice. We chose evil. Evil came into the world. Okay, what about Satan and demons? I don't have time for that because I'm going to miss out on the other ones. But I believe the biblical explanation has to be that they were not created evil, so they must also have had a choice. Okay? By the way, I don't know a verse that totally, completely nails that down. But I believe it's the only reasonable Christian explanation to that. What about pain and suffering? Now, I don't have much time for this at all, so I want to get on to hell. Not actually literally, but I want to get on to that. And slavery and all that. So, but clearly, pain and suffering is a tough question. Of course, how does naturalism do with that one? You know, too bad, tough luck.
That's life.
How does Islam do with that one? It's God's will, inshallah. Okay, that really helps, you know. But, so what about the pain and suffering? I believe almost all suffering that happens is because of evil. But not all of it, right? Who sinned, this man or his father, that he was born blind? And I believe there are most suffering is caused by evil. And there's a moral law that says if you sin, you bring suffering into the world. And to that I say, thank you, God, for that very much. Because all sin is rejecting of God, turning away from the nature, the good nature that we had. And it's going to bring, and the fact that it brings suffering into my life, that's sort of like Hello, wake up. You know? You're depressed. You're angry. You know? Everybody's walking away from you. You know, when we sin, we bring suffering into the world. And who suffers when we sin? Lots of people suffer when we sin. And I believe these moral laws are from God. You know, if you don't like God's law that you sin, you bring suffering into the world, fine. If you don't like God's law of gravity, just go ahead and defy God's law of gravity. God, I don't like your law of gravity, so walk off a cliff. Let's see how that's going to work for you. There's a lot of suffering in the world. Not all of it is caused by sin, though. There's natural causes.
Yes.
Okay, and so what about the tsunami that killed over 200,000? Why did that happen? The mullahs said it's because people weren't attending the mosque. I don't think God even wants people to go to the mosque, personally. All right, I believe the reason that tsunami happened is because of plate tectonics. And you say, I don't like plate tectonics. Well, you know, I don't like everything about it. But without plate tectonics, we'd have no atmosphere. Without plate tectonics, the surface of the Earth would become sterile a long time ago. If you don't want plate tectonics, go to Mars. There's no plate tectonics, but there's also no is sterile and there's no atmosphere. All right, and so my response would be, it would be kind of like God's response to Job, which is, where were you when I formed the earth? If you can make a better universe than the one where the atmosphere is sustained over time and the fertility of the earth is sustained over time, other than plate tectonics, please go ahead. You invent your universe. You improve on God's plan. Yeah?
Just playing
double
advocate on that one. How much of what's happening with the natural disasters of the earth are a result of what man is doing inside the earth?
I would say earthquakes. I mean, sure, the fracking is causing a few little earthquakes, and we could debate the wisdom of fracking, but I would say, sure, there's some interaction there. I don't think that's the principal thing going on there. Certainly natural disasters are natural, and that God created a universe where they do happen. I don't believe they're evil. I don't think they're wrong. I don't think they're a sign that God's not loving or that he's not powerful. Okay, I was going to talk about weather next. I was talking about typhoons. Typhoons are not evil. I say weather's good. You know, the earth is round. And the reason the earth is round is because of gravity. And if you can think of a better way to kind of pull stuff together that would have made a cylindrical shape Earth would have been better for the wet, you know, in terms of getting the energy from the sun to the Earth. Cylindrical shape would be better, but how are you going to, you have to have a universe where the forces that are natural would create a cylindrical shape thing. Natural forces create round things. Round things do not have heat spread equally. You want to spread it equally, you have to have weather, and typhoons happen, and I say weather's a good thing. If you can improve on God, then please, I'd like you to describe your world, make those natural laws, and then create that universe, and then we'll kind of go with that. Yeah.
And one other thing, this certainly isn't the leading thing when you're talking to somebody about the problem of evil, is that the greatest evil isn't to die.
Right, death is certainly not evil.
But you can't lead with that because, you know, that sounds, unless you are a Christian, sounds really bad. But, I mean, really, the greatest evil isn't to die.
No. Yeah.
And the passage in parallel with all that is, the rain falls on the wicked.
Right. Yeah. Right. Pain is not evil. If it weren't for pain, no child would make it to their sixth year.
Yeah.
All right. Now, does chronic pain, when people are suffering incredible, excruciating pain that goes on for months and months and months, does that create a problem? Well, whether it creates an intellectual problem for Christianity, I don't think so. But does it create an emotional problem? You bet it does. But again, I believe that Christianity offers the only satisfactory answer to this question. And I'm going to get to that. We haven't gotten there yet. Suffering is certainly not evil. I could do an hour lesson on why suffering is not evil. If there were no suffering, there'd be no joy, etc., etc., etc. All right, so let's think about other worldviews and suffering. What about the Hindu worldview? Suffering is an illusion. Now, who does most of the benevolent work to relieve the effects of suffering in India today? Christian groups. Why? Because they're cold-hearted, hateful people? I don't think so. But because their worldview says a suffering is not real. I think it's part of it. And also because we're doing so much helping, they can almost, you know, we kind of take over there. Okay, so that's the Eastern response to suffering is to say it's not real. The Buddhist worldview says the correct attitude towards the world is dispassion. It is emotionally, completely, and utterly removing yourself from everything that happens in this world. What's that going to do about suffering? It's going to mean that you don't have to worry about it.
No.
It's not going to do much to help it, though, huh? Okay, what about the atheist approach? You say, tough beans. There's no meaning to it. That's just part of the deal. What about the Islamic response to suffering, which is the second best out there? Because at least they have one of their five pillars is almsgiving. What's the problem, though? It is against their religion to use those alms for anybody who's not a Muslim. If that's not the opposite of the Christian response to suffering, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
I like Julian the Apostate. I think I might have this quote further on down here. Julian, let's see. Yeah, Julian. He says atheism here. He's talking about the Christians, trust me. He's Constantine's son, just so you know. The Christian faith has been especially advanced through the loving service rendered to other Christians and other Christians alone.
No.
To strangers. And through their care for the burial of the dead. It is a scandal that there's not a single Jew as a beggar. He's talking about the Christians, just so you know. And that the godless Galileans care not only for their own poor, but for ours as well. While those who belong to us look in vain for the help that we should render them. The Christian response to suffering is compassion. Why? Because suffering is evil? No. Because suffering is bad? No. Because we love people. That's the Christian response to suffering. And I'd say it's by far the best that's out there. No other worldview can support, I believe, can even come close to the Christian response to suffering. What about all that violence? What about that genocide going on in the Old Testament? Wow. Wow, this is as far as we got on Tuesday night. One of our visitors had some problems with this. I know, I was almost happy. But I told her we're going to come back to this. And so on Tuesday, we're going to start right here. Oh, this is a tough one. Look at 1 Samuel 15, 2 through 3. Now imagine you're not a Christian. Imagine you've read books by the new atheist, God is a moral monster. That God is a prideful, angry, vengeful, genocidal maniac. You know what I'm saying? And then you pick up 1 Samuel 15, 2 through 3. All right? And it says here, this is what the Lord of hosts says. I witnessed what the Amalekites did to the Israelites when they opposed them along the way as they were coming out of Egypt. Now go and attack the Amalekites. Completely destroy everything they have. Do not spare them. Kill men and women and children and infants, oxen and sheep, camels and donkeys. How many here are bothered by that passage? What's wrong with the rest of you? I'm just kidding. You're just busy taking notes. And by the way, we have a brother here who didn't raise his hand because on an intellectual basis, it doesn't bother because he understands that. So I don't mean to point you out, okay? But even you who understands that, you know, why that shouldn't bother us, come on. Emotionally, it has to bother you at least just a little tiny bit.
Well, yeah, if I was there.
All right, yeah, there you go. Yeah. This is tough stuff, folks. So, yeah.
I've got to raise this question.
All right.
Because I can't answer it.
Okay.
A friend of mine in my congregation, mm-hmm. his basic answer is, well, God repented of that when he read the Sermon on the Mount.
He changed his mind. Well, I assume that we're not going to go with that, because if God changes, then we're in big trouble here.
Go with that.
Right. Yeah. Well, let me. How?
The behavior is. I think you've got to
do that. What time did my class start? I'm getting near the end, right? So I hate to do this, because we've been having a lot of fun discussion, but at this point I'm going to go bump 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 bump. Okay. And if it's not satisfactory, well, we're going into lecture mode instead of discussion mode, okay? So point number one, if this doesn't bother you, I'm worried about you. Okay? If this doesn't bother you, I'm worried about you. Point number two, the skeptical argument assumes that physical death is evil. Now, by the way, none of these by itself answers this question.
Right.
In fact, any two or three together don't answer this question. And even after all 8 points or whatever, it's still like, this is still a hard question, okay? But again, I don't think there's a better answer for this question, so I'm going to go with the Christian answer to this question, even if it's a pretty hard question, all right? So the argument assumes that physical death is evil. This is a false assumption. Sin is evil, not death. And this had to do with sin, not to do with death, although death clearly happened. Number two, God has a right to judge. So part of this problem is we put ourselves emotionally into this, which, I'm sorry, but if you're not willing to put yourself emotionally into that passage, you're acting like a Buddhist, you know? I think we need to put ourselves emotionally into that passage. Because remember, what the Jews had to actually do this, folks. Do you think there was some PTSD?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In the lives of these Jews who killed children? So if you can't get emotionally engaged in this passage, you know. Yeah. But God has a right to judge. Now, my emotions are, I'm kind of disconnecting from my emotions right now when I say that. But as the father says to the child laughingly, but God says to us with a straight face, I took you in and I can take you out. And God has a right to judge. In fact, I listed one of the qualities of God, and one of those qualities is justice. And I believe that this was about justice. And I'm going to conclude by saying God's love and his justice, from a human perspective, seem to be at cross purposes. His love says, I want a relationship with you. His justice says, we cannot have a relationship.
Yeah.
And I believe that that conflict met at the cross.
Yeah.
And for some people, that has a good result. For others, not so good. And it will remain a hard question. So God has a right to judge, not us. Then there's the issue of the religion of the Amalekites, which involved throwing children into the fire, worshiping Molech, worshiping Ashtoreth, worship that involved worshiping gods by having sex with prostitutes at a temple. Their religion was absolutely disgusting, deplorable, and despicable. God loved those children. God loved the people in Sodom and Gomorrah, right? He loved them enough to send his son to die for them. What were the chances? That's point number four. What were the chances for those children? If God had left the situation alone, what were the probability of those children ending up with him in fraternity forever? Now again, if this is the only answer, I'm sorry, I'm still left wanting. In fact, it practically sounds like just an ad hoc excuse to blow off the question. But I believe it is part of the answer. For the children, God did them a favor.
Yeah.
Because I believe they're in heaven. But again, I don't think that answers the whole thing. In the case of Amalek and the Canaanites, both God's love and his justice demanded something happen. I believe his love demanded something happen, and his justice demanded something happen. Now, what God normally does is delay that until we come before him. But not always. There's many cases in the Old Testament where God said, it's enough. And who did God come in judgment on first? The Jews. Next, either God was going to create a nation or a people or he wasn't. So this is another thing. I don't like leading off with this one because, again, the bottom line, here's God's plan. All right, you could summarize the whole Bible. Here's the whole Bible. All right, this is the very, very condensed version. Genesis 1, God made everything, and it was great. Genesis 2 and 3, we rebelled against God. We brought evil into the world. Genesis 2, 3, 4. Genesis 5 through Revelation 19, God's fixing the problem. Genesis 21 and 22, excuse me, 20 and 21, God fixed the problem. We're back in the garden. Did I say it? I'm getting tired. You know what I meant, right? Yeah. That is at the beginning, not at the end. In fact, isn't that what Genesis means? All right. So God's plan was to choose a person of faith, a people, a nation, to send a covenant to send the prophets to. All of this was to send the Messiah to save us. And if you're going to have a nation, what do you also have to have? A place. So part of this was God's plan to give his people a place to live. Now, if we're going to have a nation and the year is, let's say, 1347 B.C., what's that nation have to have in order to continue to exist for any consecutive 6 months? The ability to defend themselves? Did God give them permission to go around willy-nilly conquering people and plundering and taking them their stuff?
No.
God said, all you have a right to do is to take these people. Could they torture them?
No.
All right? Very, very limited. In fact, everything God had to say about warfare with them was to limit it.
They couldn't take their stuff.
All these things. Okay, so God's plan to choose a man, a nation, a place, to bless humanity through Jesus trumps these other things. Does that leave emotional questions for you? It does for me. It is sinful to take a life of another in anger and out of greed or selfishness, but it is not sinful to take a life in war. And that gets to the just war concept, which we could go on for that for an hour. Everything God did to Israel as a nation was to limit their ability to wage war. No authority to establish an empire. No standing army, although they didn't. No cruelty, no abuse, no rape. Is this still a hard question? It is for me. All right, what about slavery? I'm going to skip that one. It's a similar kind of question, though, with a similar kind of answer. Is God a moral monster? All right. I don't think so. Did God encourage slavery? No. Would Christianity even allow that as a reasonable way to deal with people? No. Why did he allow for it? Well, we could talk about that. Does God get jealous? Let's talk about hell. What a great way to end this class. Now, which of God's qualities are you going to just kind of reject? His justice or his love? Anybody? Which would we like to jettison?
Oh, his justice.
His justice. Yeah. Unless, of course, it's the other guy, right?
Well, I don't know.
All right. Yeah,
as long as I gotta go there.
Yeah. Somebody, rapes your wife.
No, that's different.
Oh, okay. So you do like God's justice. That's still, for me, just on an emotional level, hell is troubling.
Yeah.
It just is. Now, I believe when we're in heaven, and I could offer scriptures for this. Is it already time for this class to end? Yeah. But I see the elders in heaven saying, how long before you come to judge the nations? I believe when we're in heaven, we're going
to
say,
amen.
That's right. Does God choose to send people to hell? No. Who sends them to hell? They choose to go to hell. And if people choose to be separated from God, if they choose to not love him, if they choose to not be part of their family, does God get some sort of a thrill? out of never having them be what he created them to be in the first place? But can God deny his very nature? Can God deny justice? So I think we'll be able to say with David, David talked about God's justice. You know, there's some psalms in there. They're pretty tough stuff. But I believe David is closer to God's heart on that issue than we are. And I'm not proposing you should be. You know what I'm saying? I don't know. I don't like that. I don't like hell. But I'm not going to judge God on that one, that's for sure. You know, we could read this passage in Revelation about hell. But I believe God's love and God's justice met at the cross. It comes back to the Trinity, you know. Then we're back at the same hard question we started with. What's the Trinity about? It's about the fact that God came in the flesh. Because the one contradiction in God's nature, if you want to call it that, but don't quote me on that. Be careful if you do to explain what I meant by that. Is his love said, with me forever. His justice says, you sin, you die. God's solution to that is to come and to die as a substitution for our sin. Yeah. Is that logical?
No way.
It's not logical at all. That is a stumbling block to the Greek. But to us, it's the gift and power of God. So that's my best effort in an hour and 15 minutes. And we're done.